Welcome to this week's edition of House of Comments. While most of you are recovering from the local elections, we thought it would be too soon to do a podcast looking straight at those. So instead, we've got a real great treat for you. I am Emma Burnell. I'm a journalist, theatre maker and political consultant. And I'm really delighted to be joined by Professor Tim Bale, who is at Queen, you're still at Queen Mary University, Tim, is that right?
I am indeed, yes, Queen Mary University of London. Bit of a mouthful, but yeah, that's the location.
Brilliant. But more importantly, for our purposes today, he is also the author of The Conservative Party After Brexit, Turmoil and Transformation. So Tim, why this book? Why now?
Well, I guess I have got a kind of morbid fascination with the Conservative Party because I wrote a book a few years ago called The Conservative Party from Thatcher to Cameron, which was really about how the party had got into such a mess during the 1990s and then managed to get out of it, albeit it took it a lot longer than most people normally assume for a Conservative Party because it's supposed to be the most adaptable, you know, political outfit in the world. And I guess when I thought about writing this book, which is in a way, I guess, a sequel, it was at a stage where the Conservative Party was, if you like, on the edge of a nervous breakdown. It was, you know, 2018, 2019, Theresa May was really at the kind of nadir of her fortunes. And so was the Conservative Party. And of course, in the summer of 2019, you know, many people might forget that it actually finished last in the European Parliament elections. And the Brexit Party came out, you know, with 30% or so. And, you know, many people were looking at the next general election in the Conservative Party and thinking, how on earth are we going to win this? So I suppose it was an interest in, you know, that kind of roller coaster ride. And of course, that was the bottom, if you like, of the roller coaster ride, at least up until that point. And then they quickly went on and up again because they chose Boris Johnson. So it was really a kind of fascination with the thrills and the spills, to be honest.
So you start the book in the obvious place, which is the end of Cameron, and essentially Brexit is the opening, the scene setting for the book. My question is, you end just as Rishi Sunak has taken over. And obviously there are question marks very much at the end of the book as to whether he will be able to revive their fortunes after you take us beautifully through, it's a real roller coaster ride, a rollicking read. The period of Boris Johnson, the much shorter period of Liz Truss. Why did you end it before the next general election, before those questions have been at least in part answered?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, in part, simply, it's a question of logistics in the sense that I was lucky enough to get a Levy Hume grant to do the research and the writing for the book, and that ran out and I had to return to teaching. So there was a need for me to kind of knock it on the head at some point before the next general election. And also, I guess, I quite like the idea of going out on a few question marks because, you know, one of the underlying questions, if you like, or themes of the book is, you know, how much has the Conservative Party actually changed away from being, if you like, a mainstream centre-right outfit to being, you know, this ersatz populist radical right party? And in some ways, although I think we've got indications that it's, you know, moved quite a long way along that path, I guess there are questions as to whether Rishi Sunak wants to, you know, move it off that path and bring it back towards a more kind of centrist, more familiar kind of Conservative Party, albeit a Thatcherite one, or whether he's going to go any further. And I'm not sure, you know, we'll know that in some ways until after the next general election. Indeed, you know, possibly if the Conservatives lose that general election, we might, you know, get into talking about that. The leadership contest that then follows it, because that, I guess, will provide a final answer.
So I have a kind of more fundamental question for you. All of these people are very different. Theresa May, David Cameron, Liz Truss, Boris Johnson, Rishi Sunak. So what makes a Tory a Tory? Why are they all in the same party?
Well, that is a very good question, because obviously it is a broad church, as you know, many people like to call it. I mean, all parties under first past the post are to some extent coalitions. what makes a Tory a Tory is quite a difficult one to answer, partly because it is a very adaptable force. But I do think that since the 1980s, anyway, we can quite clearly say that, you know, there is no Conservative leader and probably no Conservative MP who is not, in essence, a Thatcherite. Of the kind of bog standard variety. Now, you can say there are a couple of types, if you like, and Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak represent those two types, you know, Rishi Sunak being the fiscally conservative Margaret Thatcher, if you like, and Liz Truss being the tax-cutting revolutionary Margaret Thatcher. But I think even Boris Johnson, when you look at what he did rather than what he actually said he was going to do, is pretty much a bog standard Thatcherite, however much he liked to portray himself as some sort of one nation conservative. And I think that the same clearly is very true of David Cameron, although I think he and George Osborne were incredibly successful at presenting this idea that they were somehow kind of centrist modernizers and therefore, you know, weren't the kind of austerians that you know, in fact they were. So I think, you know, the fundamentals are still small state, low spending, low tax where possible, of course, you know, strong spending on defense, quite nationalistic. And then there's this question, which, as I say, the book goes into as to how far they're prepared to go along that kind of populist route, if you like, which, you know, pits the people, as it were, against the elites. And I think, you know, previously, most conventional conservatives wouldn't have touched that with a barge pole, except perhaps when it came to immigration. But I think, you know, many conservatives in the contemporary Conservative Party are prepared perhaps to go along that road, at least far further along it than some of their predecessors would have done.
And I mean, we talked about small state and that being a core value of the Conservatives. That's always been my impression and where I feel that they differ from, you know, my socialist politics. There's that horrible old saying that a Conservative is just a Liberal who's been mugged by reality. Is a small state Conservative in 2023 someone who's been mugged by reality? Because we don't have a small state and we have had enormous state intervention over the last 4 years.
That is brilliant, actually. I think, you know, I can't argue with that. I mean, certainly, you know, COVID was the ultimate mugger in some ways. But I think clearly, you know, the economic situation that we've got ourselves into post-COVID and indeed post-crash has to some extent meant that the Conservative Party has had to spend rather more than perhaps it would have done. Partly in reaction, I think, to what you might describe as the kind of overkill of austerity. You can argue that Cameron and Osborne just took it too far in a sense and so denuded public services that there's bound to be a pendulum effect in public opinion, which the Conservatives, if they, you know, want to stay in power, have to respond to. And of course, in some ways, that's been accelerated by the electoral coalition that they put together as a result of Brexit, which means they've ended up with a whole lot of quite culturally conservative voters, but voters who also want the state to be fairly active and at least protect them from some of the sort of vicissitudes of life. And that isn't necessarily the case for traditional conservative voters, you know, those voters who you might label blue wall, but it's certainly the case for voters who, you know, rightly or wrongly are labelled red wall.
So that's going to take me down two very different paths that I've planned out here. So I'm going to start with the Brexit path. There's always been a streak of anti-Europeanism in the Tory party, but it was confined to the fringes. Did anti-Europeanism take over the Tories, or did instead a populist right movement within the Tories find their opening through Brexit? And which would you say was the stronger force there?
Well, that is a great question. I mean, I guess I would put the two things sequentially in the sense that, and I suppose by doing that, I'm tending towards your second answer. I mean, I think it was the case that anti-Europeanism was to some extent confined to a small kind of fringe until the 1990s. And then you got that very kind of combustible chemical reaction between, on the one hand, Euroscepticism, and on the other hand, the defenestration of Margaret Thatcher, which I think pushed a lot more people towards the Eurosceptic side of things than would otherwise have been the case. I think that then, in some ways, opened up the Conservative Party, made it more vulnerable to this kind of national populism, as some would call it. I do think, you know, Euroscepticism to some extent snowballed, if you like, it built upon itself. It's almost like, and I've compared this in something else I've written some time ago, actually, to a kind of addiction to drugs. You know, you sort of start on the soft stuff and then that doesn't do it for you. And you end up, you know, trying the hard stuff, and then you need more and more and more of it. And before you know it, you're wanting to leave the European Union. And I think, you know, that meant, you know, for many conservatives, a very different kind of political economy in some ways, although still, I think, you know, very much based on this kind of small state, lower tax, low spending model, but one that really did focus on that kind of deregulation. But it also meant, of course, trying to appeal to a kind of much broader cultural politics, of which Euroscepticism, if you like, was just the kind of cutting edge.
And what do you think the Tories have gained from their turn to populism, from their change of image in that way?
Well, I mean, you know, bluntly, they've gained what was an 80-seat majority, which you know, is no bad thing. I mean, there is, some political scientists would argue, and I know some political commentators would argue, you know, an argument that there's been a realignment of the electorate, so that Brexit has in some ways engendered a sorting, if you like, by which culturally conservative people, many of whom you know, are at the kind of lower end of the income spectrum, though not all of them, many of whom left school fairly early, didn't go to university, most of whom will be kind of white, and as I say, possibly older as well. Not all of whom voted Conservative before 2016, but since 2016, as I say, they've kind of sorted into the Conservative Party. And likewise, obviously, there's been a sorting in the other direction, in the sense that there are a whole load of kind of liberal, more kind of internationalist, more socially progressive people who didn't always vote Labour or didn't always vote Liberal Democrat, who have now sorted themselves into that side of the political spectrum. For the Conservatives, this has been an advantage, at least so far, in the sense that they've managed to keep hold of some of those more, if you like, traditional conservative voters who are in it for, you know, the kind of small state, low tax, low spending, while bringing across a whole bunch of other voters who have been prepared to vote for the Conservative Party for, you know, cultural reasons, and of course, most obviously for Brexit. But the question is really whether that realignment is permanent, as some people would suggest, therefore they call it a realignment, or whether actually it's just a product of, if you like, de-alignment, in other words, people being thrown up into the air, and it will take a few years and a few elections to realise, you know, how the kaleidoscope, you know, to borrow that Tony Blair phrase, you know, how the pattern of that kaleidoscope settles.
And what have they lost? You talked about the more traditional kind of middle class. It used to be the case that graduates voted Tory, and that seems to have almost completely reversed now. So rather than just who have they lost, what do you think they've lost in their abilities to do things?
Well, I think they may have lost the future, in the sense that, you know, Britain is becoming a more socially liberal, more multi-ethnic, more multicultural society over time. And therefore, the Conservative Party might find itself stuck in a position which, you know, worked in 2017-ish, certainly in terms of vote share, certainly worked in 2019, and might be good for 2024 and an election after that. But After that, I'm not so sure. In terms of, you know, its impact on what they do, I think it does mean an awful lot of distraction. Now, in some ways, you know, that could be argued to be good. The politics of distraction, it puts, you know, people off thinking too much about the economy, about the state of public services, et cetera, if they're worried about small boats, et cetera. But it does also, I think, compromise the government's ability to actually do stuff in the realms that are really, really important, partly because it simply, I think, takes up a lot of headspace. You know, if you're arguing about, you know, Keir Starmer's view on, you know, what is and isn't a woman, if you're arguing about statues, if you're arguing about bathrooms, even if you're arguing actually about stop the boats to some extent, you're not actually focusing on people's priorities. And as we know from studies of the electorate, you know, although some of those issues do have some traction, they're nowhere near as important to most people as public services and the state of the economy. So I think the Conservatives have, in some senses, lost their grip on what is and isn't important, at least to the wider electorate, if not to, you know, those voters who they seem to be zeroing in on, and of course their own party membership.
And do you think that's permanent? One of the questions that I frequently have for right-wing friends is how do you expect anyone to be a capitalist if they can't get any capital? So does that feel at least semi-permanent with the way that, for example, they've embraced like dropping house building targets, things like that? Dropping HS2.
Yeah, I mean, I think the house building one is really, really interesting. You know, it's clear, you know, in order to, you know, regain a degree of unity in the Conservative Party, Rishi Sunak has certainly, to some extent, you know, given in to the awkward squad when it comes to planning regulation. I do think for young people in particular, you know, that sends out a message in some ways that, you know, the Conservative Party perhaps used to be the party of property owning democracy, but is now to some extent the party of the gerontocracy that owns all those houses. Having said that, however, and I don't know if you have an answer to this, I've never really, you know, been able to kind of come up with one. When you look at survey research, which asks people, you know, how important certain issues are, you'd think housing would be much, much higher up there, but it isn't. And I guess that's primarily because it's still the case that, you know, 60 odd percent of people own their own homes in this country, and therefore, you know, are doing quite well when it comes to rising house prices and don't really see a problem. But, you know, Ben Ansell from Oxford does a lot of work on this, and probably be able to say something more interesting about that.
But Ben's my next read, so there you go.
Well, there you go. So you'll need to ask him about that. But I mean, I do think that, you know, this, I guess, goes back to the question about the Conservatives in the future. You know, it might be that a lot of younger people's anger about the housing situation, you know, begins in the end to tell on the Conservative Party. And certainly if you look at, you know, you look at voters and the point at which people begin to vote Conservative, it's getting older and older and older at the moment. And of course, it's true that to a certain extent, as people age, they do get a little bit more conservative, and that's reflected in voting patterns. You know, it's going to have to be a very, very big change in that direction, I think, to help the Conservative Party in years to come. But listen, I mean, parties have got very short time horizons, as you know, Emma. So, you know, whether this question about the future really bothers many Conservatives, I think, you know, is a moot point. As long as they can win the next election and hopefully the election after that, you know, the future to some extent can go hang. It will sort itself out.
So I'm going to finish on two different scenarios and ask you to respond as if you were the advisor, Rishi Sunak's advisor. So scenario one, the Tories scrape through, they win a majority, small majority at the next election. What should they do with that majority in order to retrench their advantage?
Well, I think they will have to carry on looking to fund public services more adequately than they have done in the past, because I think, you know, if they get away with it, as it were, in 2024, I find it very difficult to believe that they'll get away with it for very much longer. I think if they do, it will be the hangover of the Corbyn years for Labour and a leader who isn't particularly inspiring on the opposition side. But that doesn't mean that they, you know, should think, oh, well, you know, if we can win in 2024 with the public services in a complete mess, we don't have to worry about them. I mean, that's precisely in some ways what happened to them after 1992. They thought they could get away with it. But, you know, you can't get away with it forever. I think the question is whether they can get away with it in 2024. So I think they would have to do that. I think they will carry on if they win with this, you know, populist radical right approach, particularly to immigration. Whether on sort of the whole anti-woke agenda, I think is another matter. I think in some ways there's a bit of a mismatch between Rishi Sunak's image anyway, and that kind of politics, although, you know, there's some very interesting stuff written about from Jess Elgott, for example, in The Guardian about Rishi Sunak actually being quite culturally conservative. So, you know, the mismatch between him as an ideologue, if you like, and that kind of politics isn't so glaring as the mismatch between the image of Rishi Sunak that most people have as kind of smooth, quite liberal, you know, kind of global kind of guy. I think, you know, they'll have to carry on in some ways with what they're doing. But that does pose a problem for them in terms of taxation, because obviously they would like to lower taxes. But I guess they will do what a Conservative government normally does, and that's lower taxes just before the election and then whack them up in explicit disguised ways after the election.
And so my other scenario is the Conservatives are defeated. Rishi Sunak steps down. You're a Conservative Party elder. What do you suggest comes next, and why isn't it Boris Johnson?
I think Boris Johnson has basically kind of shot his bolt with the Conservative Party now. I think most MPs don't see him as an effective CEO, if you like, and they've had an example now of Rishi Sunak, someone who is, and of course, you know, some of them may even remember David Cameron, who, whatever you thought of him, could at least kind of run a government. And I find it difficult to believe that they'll go back to Boris on that basis. Actually, they just don't want the chaos anymore. I think Partygate has so badly damaged him, there's no way back for him there. Famous last words. I would probably predict, whether I would give it as advice or not, them going for some kind of, you know, culture warrior leader, who is also, you know, convincingly Thatcherite as well. And that, I guess, means someone like Kemi Badenoch, or possibly Suella Braverman, although, you know, I think both of them have got weaknesses, as we saw in the leadership contest previously. But for me, I mean, if I was a betting man rather than an advisor, I probably would put my money on Kemi Badenoch, despite the fact that she's in a spot of bother with Eurosceptics at the moment because of this retained EU law bill, which means that the Conservatives aren't going to get rid of as much EU legislation as perhaps some of them wanted to.
Great, lovely. Thank you so much. Tim, where can people find you and where can people find the book?
Well, they can find me on Twitter at Prof Tim Bale. That's also the name of my blog, which just collects sort of pieces I've written for other things. And they can buy my book, obviously, at all good bookshops, including the electronic one that nobody likes to mention because of their their tax and employment policies. And it's called The Conservative Party After Brexit, Turmoil and Transformation. But listen, thanks very much, Emma. They were some really great questions, actually, and they've made me think about it quite hard.
Oh, great. Lovely. Well, I look forward to reading your next blog then. Thanks so much for coming on and talking to me, Tim. It's been really, really great. And I genuinely say this. I found it not just a good read, but an easy read. Quite often reading academic tomes can be a bit hard work for a middle brain like me, but I found it really a genuine page turner. And even though, obviously, because I'm a complete news junkie, I kind of recognized each of the events, actually seeing them laid out one after the other after the other after the other with this distance is so illuminating as to how we've got here from there. So thank you so much.
Hi, it's Charlotte. I hope you found that interview Emma did as interesting as I did. We'll be back next week dissecting those local election results. But in the meantime, please do follow us on whatever podcast app you use, share it with friends and family you think might enjoy the show, and follow us on Twitter @HOC Podcasts. Thanks so much for your support, and we'll see you next week.